The winner is Dorothy Jenkins for Night of the Iguana.
The devil's in Sweet 16. The widow's good looking, but she gets me. He's burning like Augustine.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Categorically Oscars. I'm Chris.
And I'm Cal.
And today we are returning to 1964 for the third time. We've previously done Best Original Screenplay, and then we also did the Best Actor lineup, which was interesting.
Your fave.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I love talking about Rex Harrison being an Oscar winner. And now we are going to, this is one of those lovely years where there's more categories awaiting us, and this time it is Best Costume Design, Black and White. And as we teased in the last episode, there's some pretty heavy hitters in the category, and these are pretty much all films that are primarily driven by women, so there's some really good actresses to talk about tonight. And this was your pick. So why did you pick this year and this category?
Well, you've touched on one of the main reasons why, which is that we have got, you know, so many actresses this week. You know, the women lead the films we're going to talk about, pretty much. Even the one with Richard Burton in. But yeah, we've got a lot of actresses working fairly late in their careers. I'd only seen two of these films before, which were Night of the Iguana and Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte. And that was ages ago, so I've been meaning to rewatch both of those. And also we've got Edith Head facing off against Dorothy Jenkins, two legends in terms of the costume branch, and legends of their profession even. So yeah, another battle between those. So yeah, let's dive in.
All right, let's do it. The nominees were Edith Head for A House Is Not a Home, Norma Koch for Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte, Howard Shoup for Kisses for My President, Rene Hubert for The Visit, and the winner was Dorothy Jenkins for The Night of the Iguana. So let's kick it off with A House Is Not a Home, costume designed by Edith Head, yes, who was coming to the end of, I think, like an 18-year run of constant nominations in this category. From the beginning, 1948, until I think just a couple years after this, Edith Head was nominated in every year in the category, sometimes twice, because of course it was split between black and white and color. Quite a run. And of course, a legend.
And she was obviously beloved.
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. by the Academy. Hence why we get, you know, nominees like Airport 77 or whatever we talked about. Where I think there's a good chunk of, you know, films that have gotten an Oscar nomination because she was involved in them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Including this one.
Yep. She already had 7 of her eventual 8 wins under her belt going into this year. She would, of course, later win for The Sting, would be her last. Definitely the heaviest hitter in most categories. I think if you discount Walt Disney, who, let's face it, probably didn't really deserve all of his nominations. By that I mean he probably wasn't the person who, you know, was responsible for it.
Don't get the Disney squad out in force, please.
the Disney kids of today don't even know who Walt Disney was. and, of course, John Williams with over 50 nominations to his credit. I believe Edith Head, the most nominated person in Academy history. Definitely the most nominated in this particular category. But yeah, let's talk about her costume design for A House Is Not a Home. What did we make of this film?
Well, it's adapted from this 1953 autobiography from Polly Adler, who was this brothel madam in the 1920s. I think, you know, not only can you tell it's adapted from a book, you know, what with that flashback and the voiceover at the beginning, but like it definitely seems as if the movie's main selling point is this book. Because they've even got it, you know, in the opening credits, they've got the book there alongside this, yeah, swooning theme song, which was written by Burt Bacharach, which feels really old-fashioned even for 1964. But, you know, even the film has this B-movie quality, like sort of B-movie from the late 1940s quality to it, which, you know, is not helped by the fact that the picture quality on the surviving copies is not very good. But I feel like it was probably low-grade quality anyway at the time, and made on a shoestring budget with Winters and other actors who were past their prime at this point, like Robert Taylor. And the book is the main marketing opportunity for the movie. They're relying on people having read this and wanting to see the film, wanting to see Shelley Winters as this madam back in the day.
Yeah, the quality is certainly difficult. It took me a while to, you know, kind of pore over some copies before I realized it wasn't going to get any better. And yeah, I can kind of imagine why nobody thought this film deserved kind of a Criterion treatment. it certainly isn't, you know, a classic of anything. I know I usually defend Shelley Winters when we talk about her on the podcast, but I'm not sure I can for this one. Like you say, it's just kind of a B movie with some actors and actresses who would work to scale, it seems like. And yeah, even so, it's like it's still a decade after this book came out, so they're really counting on it still being a hit. Although I suppose part of it was kind of waiting for the production code to, you know, be on its last legs so they could actually make it. Although it does feel pretty Cody in its morals, right? The ultimate message is that Polly and her employees are all just, you know, shells of their former selves because they've been destroyed by the lifestyle they've led, right? So it's a very moralistic film in that regard.
Yeah, in ways it was, in ways it wasn't. Like, I don't know, because the plot actually has quite a few things going on where you've got this mobster backdrop, it's got the plight of the prostitutes, Polly's got this romance that, you know, blows hot and cold a bit throughout. And none of these things are, like, really enthralling particularly, but it passes the time. I was surprised at how big it went with the dramatic moments. like, everything was all going along quite casually, and then we get this scene, all of a sudden, of the girl in the bathroom trying to inject heroin, and all hell breaks loose. And there isn't, like, much of a build-up to that. You know, there's maybe one scene where one of them says, oh, I can't believe I'm become a whore. And then suddenly, boom, we've got heroin involved and, you know, overdose, and it's all quite sensational. And then it becomes this moralistic tale that sort of uses this ugliness of addiction to push that forward, not in a subtle way. But the dramatic heights really do deliver. Like, there's this really great scene, the way it started, where they've got, they're spending New Year's Eve with these other prostitutes, and it's just really mournful and depressing, and, you know, which is actually quite effective. And then Lorraine just downs a shot and jumps off the balcony, and Shelley just cue the hysterics with Shelley. Ah! It's just like, and again, even with the mobsters, when the mobsters fight, one of them shouts, "You're a no good lousy pimp," and then shoots the guy in the stomach. Oh my god, it really does go for it with those moments. But yeah, I thought that they mainly came across as laughable, but yeah, I don't know. It was moralistic at the end, but I think some of the character study wasn't, because it's based on a book by the person that's telling it. Like, it wasn't a character assassination.
No, definitely not. I kind of wonder, though, how... Like, I liked the big moments and the over-the-top moments. It kind of made me think that this is the film it wanted to be. And I wonder if they'd waited a few years until the 60s had really taken hold, and this could have been, like, a late 60s, really, like, gaudy color picture, so, like, lean into the 60s camp, really go for those, like... You know, the heroin withdrawal scene could have been so much bigger. Like, I feel like it wanted, or like it was trying not to be a camp classic, even though clearly those moments were coming through no matter how much they tried to hide it. And if they just leaned into that entirely, or even waited till the 70s to make it and make it a kind of like Other Side of Midnight melodrama, it could have been, I think, a classic for all the right reasons. But unfortunately, yeah, it seems to kind of shy away from those big moments in some places and go big in others. I do agree, though, that there are some good moments of like character development and kind of showing, not so much, I mean, realistic, I guess would be a strong way of putting it, but there are flashes of like genuine examination of the kind of life that Polly Adler and these women would have been leading in this situation.
Yeah, that was the real positive of it, I think, because the nature of it as an adaptation, like, it helps it to be a bit more of a mixed portrayal, because they have waited until Polly Adler in real life had died pretty much the year after she died they made the film, so they're really taking advantage of that. But, you know, they could have turned it into this, you know, Polly is this blood-sucking, manipulative person. But it kind of lionizes her quite a bit at times. She kind of comes across a bit matriarchal. She cares about the women. But then she sort of moves from tragedy to tragedy without seeming to learn from that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she doesn't learn from the overdose. Lorraine then jumps off the balcony, so she's not saving anybody, is she, by her behaviour? And then it gets all judgy later on. It's like, oh, she cannot be happy. And that's when it does get cold-like. But I thought Winters did a decent job. I think the script has way too many people being kind to Polly for no reason. Like, I don't know how she's managed to get in this situation. That was complete luck at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, she didn't. I thought Winters could have overplayed it more, because she tended to go big with stuff. Whereas with this, I think she showed a bit of restraint. I wish that it was a bit more ambitious with the way some of the scenes are shot. Like, it's just very much treated as if it's a play almost. It's very static.
Or even a TV movie.
Yeah, there aren't many scenes of anybody outside a building. It's all, like, internal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the supporting characters could be a bit more fleshed out. There were a lot of little things that could have been done to make this kind of good, as opposed to mediocre or average. Because I wasn't disappointed I watched it, but I was just left wanting a little bit more at times, really.
Apparently Raquel Welch, this is her film debut. I definitely missed her, but she was one of Polly's call girls in it. I don't know if you noticed her.
No, I didn't actually. No. Because she got quite famous very soon after this, didn't she? I think, I mean, it's the kind of film where you would miss things because the quality's not very good. It's,
Right, yeah.
Including the costumes. I mean, we're judging the costumes. It's already at a disadvantage because of the quality of what we can see, especially what's not in close-up.
Yeah, it is quite difficult. From what I could see, I mean, the costumes are quite, you know, glamorous. Clearly, Polly used some of the money wisely to, you know, invest in some really nice quality outfits for her girls. You know, there's a lot of satin, a lot of silk, so they're very well designed. And you can see, you know, we can go online and see some of these costumes in, you know, better resolution, but certainly not all of them. So I agree. Yeah, we are kind of judging it from a point of view of a lot of blurry costumes, which is a shame.
Yeah, all of Winter's clothes, because we get close-ups, we can pretty much see them. Not the finer details of them, but you could tell they're good. So I do think it's good costume design. It's a shame we just can't see a bit more of it. But yeah, when she becomes established and she's earning more money, the quality of the dresses inevitably gets better. So in that sense, I think it's well thought out.
Any more on A House Is Not a Home?
Just that the original song is diabolical.
Yeah.
It just should be wiped off the face of the earth.
Yeah, that is. And completely out of place in the song, too. I mean, it sounds like it should be part of like a light romantic comedy or something, but suddenly not a, you know, purportedly serious examination of, you know, a bordello owner in the post-war period. But yeah. So next up we have Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. The was meant to be a direct sequel almost to Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Same director, same one of the same stars, same screenwriter, I think, or the same source material. Apparently based on a short story that he wrote but not published called Whatever Happened to Cousin Charlotte. So clearly he was thinking sequel as well.
Victor Buono's in it,
yep,
as well.
Yep, you got Victor Buono, very small role. And yeah, originally meant to be Bette Davis and Joan Crawford again, but shortly into filming, Crawford, quote-unquote, became ill, which not everybody believed. Aldrich actually hired a private investigator to track her and see if she was telling the truth or if she was just being difficult. either way, they eventually just replaced her with Olivia de Havilland and went ahead with the film. And I have to say, obviously, it's, you know, pretty high bar to set from Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, and I don't think this film quite lives up to its predecessor, despite really trying.
Is it really trying, or is it really trying, as in a chore?
Both.
I don't know. I thought better of it the first time I watched it. This time, it really, really does seem like a pale comparison.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if Crawford had been in it, it would have been quite a neat reversal of power compared with Baby Jane, the dynamic, seeing it the other way around. And I think Crawford would have done better than de Havilland does, which I actually think de Havilland's fine, but I think Crawford could pretty much do anything, to be honest.
Yeah.
But it's so similar. They even start with a flashback to the past at the beginning before the credits, and then this present day gothic horror that's going to dominate things.
Yeah. And just kind of a really over the top murder too. Like I kept waiting for there to be some reason why he would be
decapitated.
His hand would be cut off and he would be decapitated. Why the murder was so gruesome, that never gets resolved. It's only to set up the later, like, psychological manipulation that that Miriam and Drew perform. But it's still, in the moment, absolutely no reason for the murder to be that ridiculously bloody. You know, whatever happened to just, you know, stabbing somebody in the chest, that works, you know? You don't have to...
It was very Roger Corman, wasn't it? It's like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much. Yeah.
It's, I mean, yeah, that bit was grotesque, but in general, like, it didn't have the same level of grotesquerie and tragedy that the Baby Jane had.
Yeah.
And that family link doesn't work as strongly here. We don't really get enough scenes between Charlotte and Miriam at the beginning to establish a connection or a rivalry or, you know, nothing really major there to carry it through the present day. It's just sort of, we get this distant relative visiting and the history doesn't really become part of their relationship. But yeah. But what I found strange about it is that some of the drama is with the Gothic horror is so heightened and so sensational. But then the main twist, unless I'm completely reading this wrong, the main twist is the scene where we get Miriam saying to Joseph Cotton, "Your artist friend in New Orleans has quite the talent." That is the first time we know, right? Or we're supposed to know that they've been plotting.
I think so, yeah.
So when it's actually revealed that they've been hatching this plan all along, it's this strangely casual scene. It's not much of a reveal, which might be because the one before that with the head rolling down the stairs is, like, you know, just so dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't clear from the scene where the head rolls down the stairs that Miriam's done that on purpose and is involved. It could be that she's just, somebody's dropped that there and she's, you know, somebody else is playing with her, maybe Joseph Cotton on his own. So it wasn't clear. So in terms of the actual reveal that they're gaslighting her and they have been all along, it didn't take advantage of that moment fully for me. I thought it could have really done it in a way that's like, oh, okay, so you really are that callous. This really has been going on all along. Whereas it just seemed a bit matter of fact in the moment.
Yeah, I agree. It was not handled very well, not paced very well. And yeah, I hate to say it because I really do. I love Olivia de Havilland, but I don't think she's great in this role. Like, she's not diabolical enough. Like, thinking again, like, the roles reversed, thinking back to, like, Betty Davis's Baby Jane, like, legitimately unhinged. And obviously, Miriam is a bit more calculating and a bit more sane, I guess, but she still needs that kind of, like, evil edge that I think Joan Crawford could have really done much better. And it seems to me like maybe they didn't take, I mean, obviously Crawford dropped out when they'd already started, so they kind of had to get on with it, but it seemed like they could have done more to adapt the script or Miriam's role to fit de Havilland a little better, or at least given her a little more time to kind of make the character her own. It seems to me like she's kind of doing the part the way it was written for Joan Crawford, and it doesn't quite work as well, or at least it didn't work as well for me. And maybe that's part of the reason why the twists and the reveals kind of lacked those, the kind of gravitas that it needed. Because, yeah, I just felt like de Havilland wasn't the right role for her. And maybe with a bit of tweaking, it could have been. But as it was, she was just kind of doing the role that Joan Crawford should have been in.
I mean, I think if Joan Crawford, you know, wasn't ill, she's really missed a trick at getting out this film, because I think she probably would have been nominated for this, because it would have been a nice way of saying, okay, we nominated Davis the last time, we'll nominate you. And the film got 7 nominations anyway, so it's clearly well-liked. So I think it would have been the perfect opportunity for her. But as it stands, the performances are all at odds with each other, you know, and not always in the right ways. I think Davis is flat out bad in this. And, you know, with a really inconsistent Southern accent, but just in this role of somebody driven mad, that didn't, as a victim, didn't work for me. You're right, de Havilland downplays it too much. Agnes Moorehead, who for me gives the best performance in the film, just off the leash and going for it in a really broad way, but maybe the only character in the movie I was really cheering for, in a way. And, you know, I think once Velma sort of departs, I was kind of sad because she's really fun. I think the moment where she's pushed down the stairs, even though de Havilland downplays it too much for me and seems like she's actually sorry for what she's done, whereas it would have been good if she'd doubled down on the evil elements of it a bit more. But that moment is better for me as a sequence than Elvira being killed in Baby Jane, for instance, because of what Agnes Moorehead's brought to the role, and because she's played as a character, she's played a bigger part in the film up to then. And also a step up, I think, is the cinematography from Joseph Baroque, which I thought was just brilliant. Like, it reminded me of some of the best cinematography I've seen from the 1940s, in the way that the framing and the shadows inflated the power struggle at times. You know, everything where she's been, you know, in the middle of the night, and the glass and the stairs. And I thought it just showed off Charlotte's vulnerability really well. So I loved the cinematography.
Yeah, the cinematography is really nice. And just, yeah, overall, the film looked very good. The set design also was excellent. And they didn't really, in a lot of ways, they didn't use that kind of gothic setting to the advantage that they did in Baby Jane. I think that's kind of the story of this whole film, is not living up to Baby Jane. But quite good set decoration, quite good cinematography, and it was, of course, nominated in those other categories as well.
Yeah, and that's deserving, definitely.
Yep.
I wanted to highlight a better 1964 Bette Davis thriller. I don't know if you've seen Dead Ringer, which it's this really entertaining thriller about a twin who murders a sister and then assumes her identity. And then things go wrong that she hadn't foreseen because she didn't know enough about her sister's life. And it's a really fun movie. Which is definitely better than this one. And also Lady in a Cage with de Havilland is this year too, where she plays a woman stuck in an elevator, and she ends up being terrorised by the local riffraff, who kind of, they're the only ones that respond to her alarm. And so those are two great films from 1964, and lots of genre opportunities, I think, for old Hollywood stars at this time. And genre films that are well worth a watch. I think Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte is just a bit too much of a mixed bag, really. A bit long as well. I think there's quite a bit that could have been cut out of it.
Yeah, very much so. And yeah, the accent work is questionable, to say the least. Joseph Cotten in particular should have just given up. he's kind of sliding weirdly between southern stereotypical sounds, but then just his own voice half the time, so it really sounds bizarre. At least de Havilland's is subtle, so it's not quite as noticeable when she doesn't nail it, but yeah, he's really seems like he's trying to do it, but he was really cringy.
And Davis only really bothers at the end of the sentences to do it.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time she's mm-hmm. shouting, so she can't control it properly. The costumes. Now, we have a serious issue with the costume design. Are you aware of this?
Go for it.
We have an authenticity problem here with the costume design, which is that because Joan Crawford dropped out of this partly into filming, there wasn't time to redo her dresses for de Havilland. And so everything that Miriam de Havilland wears in the film is from de Havilland's own personal wardrobe.
Hmm.
Which sort of begs the question, how much of this is costume design? Because I feel like we need to dock points for this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably have to.
Because, I mean, otherwise, I did like the costume design. To be honest, particularly Joseph Cotton's outfits, all these southerly gentleman outfits that he wears, is kind of in keeping with that Confederate vibe, and that worked for me.
Yeah.
But hearing about the de Havilland situation was a bit disappointing.
Mm-hmm. Although that is, I mean, she's got some... That's some really nice clothing just to throw on at a moment's notice. But yeah, and I also thought that Davis's costumes were really well designed, again, kind of capturing that faded Southern Belle kind of look. The clothes had a kind of worn quality to them that worked really well for the character. So yeah, I guess with the exception of the fact that there was no costume design for de Havilland, I think the costume design is really good. And, you know, Agnes Moorehead's costumes are appropriately shabby for her character.
But yeah, I disappointed with the film as a whole, because it could have been a lot better. I mean, we know it could have been a lot better because all of the same components from the last film were there, pretty much apart from Joan Crawford. And de Havilland doesn't ruin this. It's a combination of different factors, particularly the script, I think. And also Mary Astor, I think, is really great in her handful of scenes. She could have done with a bit more for me. That character could have become a bit more a part of it.
Can't win them all. And even if you got Betty Davis and in a role that she should have been much better in. Maybe she just needed, for this kind of role, maybe she just needed the kind of hatred that she had with Joan Crawford to really make the performance pop. Because I think de Havilland and Davis were friends, right? So there was none of that smoldering dislike under the surface of the performances. So it kind of loses that Baby Jane had.
I feel like we've been quite negative, and it's not going to get any better soon.
No, it's not. Kisses for my president. Wouldn't it be wacky if a lady was president? That is the premise of this film and kind of where they started and stopped, it seems, with the brainstorming for pretty much all of the jokes. Kisses for my president, starring Polly Bergen and Fred McMurray as the president and first man, first husband, if you will, of the United States. Newly elected because apparently all the women in America voted for her, because it's not really clear how she got involved in the running for president, or maybe I missed that. But it just kind of is like, he's a business owner, right? And then suddenly she's president. And that's where we start
the
film.
You'd think she'd won it in a competition or something, wouldn't you? Like...
Yeah, she. That's almost how everybody is treating it, including, she has a strangely casual attitude to being president. which I think most people would agree is a pretty big deal. And she's just kind of her first night with her husband, and she's just they're like casually chatting about which bedroom is which and where they're going to be each night and blah, blah, blah. And not like, holy crap, we're, you know, she's president of the United States. And it kind of just sets the tone for the whole thing. And it's pretty clear he's not going to be supportive of anything, and mostly just whine the whole time, and he does.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't you think there'd be like a couple of scenes where somebody would come in and say, oh, there's been an earthquake in San Francisco, something's happened, and just nothing happens. She has nothing to deal with, apart from being a woman.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that this was made when JFK was alive, because it's definitely approaching the subject of the presidency as if this is a changing world. Like, because you've got, at that time, you've got the youngest ever president, somebody that's fairly cool, not the stuffy, super serious presidents there's been in the past. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that maybe a woman's time will come maybe doesn't feel like that distant a notion. I'm trying to rationalise the thinking behind this. Because what's most depressing about this film is that 60 years later, there still hasn't been a woman president of the United States.
Yeah.
But is that a surprise when you've got films like this that ultimately reinforce the idea that women should bear the children and do as they're told? Because, honestly, I hated this movie. But I think the reason I hate it the most is because it seemed vaguely progressive at first. And by the time it got to the end, I was wondering whether the people behind the script are actually more petrified of the idea that there might be a woman president than interested in what the implications of that would be. So it sort of gradually revealed its true colours in a way that showed it up for being totally insidious and sexist and just a bit of a, again, disappointing, but worse than disappointing, you know, damaging piece of work.
Yeah, I entirely agree, and I hated it as well. It was just kind of, just a chore to get through, and the fact that, there's nothing for the president to do except, have a few meetings with a South American dictator and kind of put him in his place. But ultimately, what really puts him in his place are the Soviets, not her, is also kind of undercutting. The main drama of the film is not anything to do with the fact that she's president. It's more like, oh, her husband's at a loose end now. How does he cope with, being second fiddle to the president of the United States? It's like, I don't agree with the stereotype or the stereotypical joke that the husband, with a less important role than the wife is automatically hilarious because, this isn't what it's supposed to be like. But even if you accept that premise as fodder for comedy, does it really work when the wife is literally the president and the husband still can't bring himself to accept that she's got more important things to do than keep him company?
His biggest problem in this is like, oh, he's got a four-poster bed with a flowery bedspread. Like, it's...
Yeah. Oh. The horror.
Yeah, I remember when we talked about The Devil Wears Prada, and you said you were disappointed that the film was basically discussing how a woman's new career affects her relationship with a boyfriend.
Yeah.
And this is basically the same thing. Although 40 years earlier, you would expect that mode of thinking, sadly. But, talk about a film that just goes nowhere. Like, it's mining comedy from the fact that the gender roles are reversed, the emasculation of Fred McMurray. But it's not even funny. Like, it's the only scene I vaguely chuckled at was where the butler's constantly trying to hide her newspaper. That was the only thing I thought was vaguely amusing. There were no real jokes in it, proper jokes. And the Venezuela subplot's just dreadful. I think it's obviously a thinly veiled reference to the relationship with Cuba and Castro. Clearly very anti-Castro, very anti-dictatorship, which is fine. But yeah, also anti-common sense, though, I think. Like, if she's so polished a politician, would she really send her husband to entertain a South American world leader and show him around town? Like, that seems like such a bad idea. And at no point does the script seem to be thinking, oh, we're discussing... we've got a main character or a main female character that's actually managed to get to this position. how has she done this? What qualities must she have to have got here? You just don't see any of that.
And then when that subplot does ultimately come to a head, it's not even the president, it's not even her who, you know, strikes the final blow. It's her husband, right? Her husband gets the big reveal at the hearing, like, I have here some damning evidence, and it, you know, ends the whole thing. So she doesn't even get that. She doesn't even get to be the person who diffuses this situation, you know, kind of, you know, not even that exciting a situation as it is, but she couldn't even do that. Instead, in the last, like, 90 seconds of the film, she faints, discovers she's pregnant, resigns, and they're gone.
I think, you know, that's the worst part, isn't it? That the end, what the hell? That dragged it from, like, 2 stars down to 1 star for me, that ending. I just couldn't, like, because first of all, you're right, it's extremely rushed. I saw there was like 2 minutes left in the film and I'm thinking, what's going on? There's not been a culmination. What's going to happen? Is there going to be a Senate vote? There's talk that, you know, they're trying to force her out at some point. There might be a plot to get rid of her. And then, yeah, she just faints and makes a short speech. And the doctors have said it'd be dangerous for me to continue and therefore I'm going to resign. And it must be 90 seconds. It can't be any more than 90 seconds where all this happens. And then there's that terrible joke at the end that, oh, it took millions of women to get her in the White House and only one man to get her out of it. And she doesn't seem the least bit bothered that, you know, presumably her life's ambition has just been wiped out. Just oh dear.
Yeah, she's just like, oh yeah, you know, I'm much happier to raise another child because my other two have turned out so well. It's another subplot that never gets resolved. Her two children are just the worst, and they will presumably continue to be the worst because they'll get Secret Service protection for life because their mom was president. So her daughter will continue to waste her time with, you know, frivolous boys, and her son will continue to be just a jerk. Yeah, really bad. Just across the board bad.
And I have to say, and I don't like to be mean about actresses, but another thing that doesn't help the movie is that Polly Bergen just isn't very good in this. She's just kind of sleepwalking through it. And to be fair, you know, the script is not asking a lot of her because it's sexist, but I feel like she really doesn't get out of second gear. Like, even when she's supposed to be angry after the whole strip club incident, she just looks a bit put out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not really familiar with her as an actress, but I wouldn't be rushing to seek out anything else she's in based on this. And Fred McMurray is just showing up, basically, and, you know, trying to be charming, which he can be, but it's not in service of anything here.
No, yeah, it's been... yeah, she's not doing much of anything in the role. She doesn't have much to do, though, does she? So maybe it's not her fault. But, yeah, she's not really putting in much effort. Nobody really is.
What about the costume designer, Howard Shoup?
I mean, nothing really jumped out as particularly noteworthy. It all seemed very, you know, just clothes that business people and politicians of the time would wear. Nothing to me really stood out about the costume design.
Yeah, there's a lot of like women in charge outfits. Women, you know, suits, pantsuits. And there's some smart tailoring. The quality of the picture was good, like, so we could actually see the tailoring. it's fine, but the designs, like the film, you know, they aren't particularly creative. I wouldn't single out the costumes as a highlight, even given all the other problems with it, really. I mean, they probably are the highlight, but a highlight of a a real dud of a movie. I can't, I mean, what other element would be the highlight?
Yeah, I suppose that's true. Yeah, nothing.
I don't know. I don't know if they didn't get to use the White House, I assume, right? This isn't the...
No, I don't.
This is just a set.
Seems like a set. It certainly looks more like a set. Oh, and that reminds me of the weirdest thing. Literally like 5 minutes from the end, we get that sequence where he's like hopped up on pain medication and booze, and he gives that tour. What was that doing at the climax of the movie? Like, if anything, that's like a comedy set piece from like the first act to show him kind of blundering around in his new role. Why were we watching that 5 minutes from the end of the film? It's so out of place and so ridiculous. Oh, nobody knew what they were doing on this film.
Yeah, so pretty dire, sadly. Yeah, for all involved.
But from the White House to the old world, not entirely clear which country this film is set in, but it's The Visit.
It's a typical Anthony Quinn thing, isn't it, where it's just foreign.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Vaguely European, and that's all you need to know. Because they do talk about in terms of dollars, so it's almost like they weren't even pretending to be in a real place. It was just kind of a European country where they use U.S. dollars. But whatever. The Visit. If it matters, it was shot in Italy, so that could give us a clue. But yeah, The Visit. What did we make of The Visit?
Okay, from here it gets better. I really liked it. But I think, good. So this is the positivity, people. It's getting better. It's getting better. Yeah, this is Renee Hubert, who I don't know very well, but it's his second nomination. He did Desiree, which Brando plays Napoleon. So that would be, sounds interesting, or maybe just a vanity project, one of many for Brando. But yeah, I thought The Visit was, I was at least expecting The Visit was going to be better than the last time we watched a film where Ingrid Bergman went back to her hometown, which was Saratoga Trug, just awful. A total mess. Yeah, The Visit, I think what we get is this intense, emotional, like cerebrally satisfying drama. I thought it was quite intelligent and yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was really good. I had no idea about the plot or anything going into it, so it kind of unfolds in this very like Kafka-esque manner, getting more and more absurdist and more uncomfortable as it goes on. And I thought it was paced really well, and I loved, you know, how Carla, Ingrid Bergman's character, is just kind of portrayed as this like almost goddess just sitting on her balcony, watching the chaos unfold slowly. It was really, I mean, it really does a good job of establishing a pretty creepy atmosphere as the town kind of transforms into this prison almost for Serge, and everybody starts acting over the top friendly while they, you know, turn on him. It was very, very creepy, and I thought some interesting camera work and cinematography, lots of like uncomfortable close-ups and stuff to highlight his isolation as claustrophobia.
Yeah, it's strange to think that it's adapted from a play because it is very cinematic at times. I think, I mean, the Kafka comparison's right on. The only kind of drawback for me preventing this from being amazing is that the film is completely predictable from start to finish.
Mm.
Like, because it's essentially a fable, it's got that sort of element to it about how greed can corrupt people. And I do think the town shift is a bit extreme, like when they're suddenly taunting him when he's trying to get the train. But you know, that's just a bit of a sudden shift. But I sort of felt like I knew where it was going, and I knew that that's how it was going to end as well. But even so, like, I think it just caught me by surprise. Like, I wasn't expecting it to be so psychologically interesting. It's a great premise. It's a great sort of way of enacting revenge on somebody, whether he dies or not, because it's the psychological torture that that Carl is enacting on him. But the script is like unexpectedly generous and really frank about love and loss and mistakes, and giving into society. And it really didn't need to be that generous. Like, they really took the time to convince us that it could have gone in another direction and maybe they could have been happy once, even though, you know, he was a complete dick to her and mm-hmm. she's completely justified.
Yeah.
Their connection completely came through, and the strengths of the scenes between Ingrid Bergman and Anthony Quinn on their own, I think, is just incredible. Like, not just the way they're acted, but how emotionally honest the content of the conversations are that they have. Mm-hmm. Where Serge goes to, like, throttle her, and they talk about the reasons why he wouldn't marry her, and they discuss the child they've lost. It's just really, really affecting, and Bergman is supercharged in that moment. And I think she even kind of elevates Quinn. So I feel like they're getting the best out of each other, or at least she's getting the best out of him.
Yeah.
Because he's probably thinking, shit, I really need to bring it to this scene. This is intense. And then, you know, later on, there's a scene where they make out on the evening before the trial, and it's just full of passion, which Anthony Quinn could definitely do passion. But I just think together they're really magic. The chemistry comes through. Ingrid Bergman, 10 years older than the character's supposed to be when she's filming this, but I think it probably needed somebody a little bit maturer to tap into some of the issues at the heart of the film, like the sexual double standards the film's discussing. You know, probably needed somebody who'd been through it, and we know that Bergman's sort of ostracization from Hollywood and things, you know, that had happened, you know, maybe tapping into this a little bit. But yeah, it just was very impassioned from start to finish, and it drew you in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And a lot of it, like you say, is the two performances where when they're together, they really do bring out that passion in each other. And I especially like the first meeting they have before she reveals the purpose of her visit and before it all goes, you know, south. They manage to get the backstory out and a lot of exposition, but the script and the acting together, it doesn't feel exposition-y. It really does feel like two people reminiscing.
Yeah.
And, you know, Serge obviously very carefully choosing his words and how he's framing the past because he knows, you know, and Carla kind of getting in those subtle hints that, you know, she has not forgiven or forgotten what happened. It's a really charged scene that really, you know, foreshadows what's about to happen at the reception. Yeah, it's just really, really fantastic. And then, of course, the one later where they have that moment where it's like, yeah, they realize it could have been so different. But now, of course, there's no going back. There's scenes together that, like, it's like a moor or something, like an abandoned shed or something, whatever it was. Really great. Really great. Highlight of the film, to be sure.
I did read that Burton and Taylor were down to do this at one point. I just think, thank God. Thank God they didn't.
Oh, yeah. No, that would not have been good.
But it is very... I mean, Bergman's character is such a diva in this film. And it is wonderful to watch. Like, I even love... I mean, the end. Talk about a film announcing it's over. You know, sort of indirectly announcing it's over when she says, the visit is over, and just gets in the car, just drives up, yep. And that's the end of the movie. it's just perfect, yep. Yeah.
Perfect.
yes, even though, like, all of the story beats are pretty much what you'd expect, it was just the detail that had gone into it and the sort of audience gratification that could be got from some of the elements of it, which, you know, we're going to talk about the costumes. The costumes, I think, play into their part in that too. Certainly in terms of Bergman, but I've never seen Bergman be quite this domineering in a performance. Like, maybe, I mean, Autumn Sonata is domineering, but that's domineering in another way. This is sort of magnetic, her presence in this.
Oh, no, her costumes in this are absolutely stunning, and really kind of I mean, obviously, the contrast between her extreme wealth and the town's poverty is part of it, but also just the way her costumes kind of project her power. As I said, she's like standing like a queen on the balcony looking down at her subjects, and her clothes really have that kind of regal projection, that regal quality to them. And the costumes of all the townspeople, again, are very like kind of, until she starts buying them all new clothes, of course, are all very kind of dingy and like reflecting of like the, however long the depression of the town's been going on, at least 10 years at this point, I think express it so well. I did like the reveal, quick tangent, I loved the reveal that she was literally responsible for the town's economic downturn by buying the factory and closing it, because that is like really, really ruthless. But of course, she's justified in everything she's doing to these people, because not just Serge, the whole town deserved what they got from her, which also made it a very satisfying film to watch. You're basically cheering her on the whole time, which is just fun. Although, did she have to actually get her cat killed? That was the only part that of her plan that didn't really make sense to me. Do you remember when her cat, I'm not sure it was really a panther, it looked more like a cheetah, but anyway, it said, oh, her cat's gotten out, everybody get a gun and go out wildly shooting. It's obviously just a plan to get Serge in the line of fire, right? But then her cat actually was loose and does get killed by Serge's wife. I don't understand why she didn't just hide the cat somewhere in her apartment and just say, hey, he's gone, everybody go out shooting. Why did she actually have to send her cat out to get killed to make that happen? That was the only part of her plan that I didn't quite get.
Well, either she didn't care about the cat, or maybe there was a decoy cat, I don't know. But yeah. in terms of the costumes, as soon as she gets off the train and she's wearing this white outfit and fur with pearls and the hat set to one side, perfect silhouette, you're thinking, okay, we've started here.
Yeah.
Immediately. Mm-hmm. Some of these films we've watched, you can forget about the costumes. This, you just can't, because every few minutes there's another costume and you're thinking, whoa, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, Renee Hubert has made such an effort with the accessories as well. Her sunglasses, mm-hmm, in the scene with the, mm-hmm, I thought it was a leopard, but a cheetah or whatever it was, in the cage behind. Just such a moment with those sunglasses.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a parasol at one point, which she's got on the balcony, which kind of reminded me a little bit of Death in Venice, which would be a few years after this. This black studded hat she wears at the trial. Yeah. I think, to be honest, it's a situation where the film's clearly only been nominated for maybe 4 or 5 outfits, not the whole, you know, outfit of all the characters. But that doesn't really matter, because those 4 or 5 outfits are delivering in an iconic way. And they're doing what the film needs to. So it's definitely a case of, yeah, you've made 5 outfits, but you've made them really high quality and really effective.
Well, these 4 films we just talked about, well, they all lost, because the winner was Dorothy Jeakins for The Night of the Iguana. We've definitely talked a lot of Tennessee Williams adaptations on the podcast, and this is the latest in a line. But, of course, he was not involved in this one, was he? Or at least he wasn't involved in writing the screenplay, which was, you know, bit of a departure. He usually had a hand in these adaptations, but what did we make of The Night of the Iguana?
Well, I know he was, I think he was certainly impressed with it, certainly impressed with Ava Gardner, who he then became lifelong friends with. I want to call John Huston out. We've said this before, but I think this is another example of John Huston just drifting towards films set in exotic climates. Like, we talked about African Queen. He went to the Italian Riviera for Beat the Devil. This is in Mexico, under the volcano. He went back to Mexico to film that. So it's kind of like anything for a free trip away with John Huston. But yeah, I do like that Mexico is a backdrop in this. And they apparently they have a statue of John Huston in the town where this was filmed because it got them so much tourism. The movie, there's still a statue of him there, which is kind of random.
Interesting.
But yeah, I like the film. I think it's messy, but that's kind of where Tennessee Williams was heading at this point.
Yeah. No, I like it as well. Very messy. And Richard Burton just chews the scenery to shreds in this film. My God. I mean, I love it when he does that. When he goes big, he's always entertaining. But yeah, he's got some huge moments in this for sure, where he's screaming to the, screaming to the heavens, literally in some cases. And I thought Ava Gardner was, fantastic in it, and Deborah Kerr as well. So the acting, really, really strong, I have to say. The plot kind of goes along until it just kind of ends. There isn't a lot of resolution to anything. Certainly not to what's built up as kind of even the central conflict of the film is not that intriguing. It's like, is he going to get fired or not?
Yeah.
Who cares? They're just, it doesn't matter. They're at this hotel. What really matters is how they're going to, bounce off each other. So, when you're watching this film, you quickly stop caring about the plot and you're just kind of drawn into these characters and how they are interacting and how they're going to, what they're going to reveal about each other is more the draw of the film to me than whatever's happening with him and his employment with this, bottom of the barrel tourism company.
Yeah, the plot's a bit of a mess. It's kind of needlessly complicated and it's very sprawling. You're right, these things don't have a resolution, but then the film also starts in a place where it's like, I feel like we already should have seen episode one before the film starts. I don't know why they don't just turn up at the hotel and everything happens there, because it's a play anyway, so it'd be so much simpler without all of that business with the distributor valve and him having to run up the hill. Why not just have, Maxine's written him a letter saying her husband's died, but he's not received it, so she's not expecting him, or something like that, that would have just easily explained that away. Instead, we get all of this other commotion that's extremely, distracting. The setup didn't work for me. I think Williams definitely got wilder as he got older, wilder with the presentation of his ideas, but I think that also extends to the structure in a way that doesn't help. It's a little bit too loose overall, but
yeah. Well, I guess it kind of comes from the play itself, right? Because I think it started as a one-act play originally, and I think it did open with coming to the hotel. Like, that was the first scene. Shannon shows up. He's got the group of women behind him. And then over the years, Williams kind of kept expanding it until it was a, full-length three-act play. So I think that could be part of it, that the play began much maybe tighter or shorter, and he was kind of like adding to it as he went along until he arrived at a full-length play. So I do agree that I think the first scene should have been just showing up at the hotel, and kind of the backstory could have been filled in just as easily if we hadn't seen it. I feel like the opening scene in the church is big, and it's fun to see Richard Burton just lose his mind. But at the same time, in terms of the structure of the film, maybe we don't entirely need it.
Yeah, I think one act would have been absolutely fine, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, the film, it's got this really restless quality to it. And it really does feel like everything's slowly falling apart, which you tend to get with all of his work. But it's kind of like Shannon's career's on the skids. Maxine's husband's just died. Judith's repression's making her hysterical. And it's kind of a lot about censorship, which I like. It's a lot about religion as a weapon, people who don't fall into line with a certain way of looking at things, at the world, end up sort of pushed to one side, which kind of fits with, you know, a lot with William's artistry and homosexuality and all the rest of it. But the way that this differs for me, which I only got from a second viewing, this is why it might not have done so well with the Oscars, is that I think it's basically a comedy. And some of which you can't really say about his other films or most of his other films. Because some of this is just hilarious, especially with Ava Gardner, some of Ava Gardner's quips. What she says about Hannah, you're just a deadbeat pushing that old man around like a Chinese beggar, which is just, was just brilliant. And everything with the grandfather was funny, except the end, which is actually quite moving. But yeah, I wasn't sure if they were supposed to be crooks, he and the granddaughter.
Yeah.
Because the way he shouts when he's drunk, he shouts something like, oh, let's work the cocktail lounge first, we'll get more money or something like that. And I'm thinking, oh, are they actually like a pair of card sharps or something? I didn't really know if that was supposed to be a thing. But yeah, there's all this comedy through it. And even the monologue that Deborah Carr, I don't know what Deborah Carr must have been thinking reading this script. this monologue she has about the kinky Hong Kong businessman who asks her to take a piece of his clothing off and throw it to him. The way that she relays that story is done with such grace and sincerity that it's so funny. Just really, really kooky film in its way, with, you know, so much invention in it. A lot of unfocused invention, but, you know, whenever I kind of revisit this, I appreciate it a bit more. Because what it lacks in structure and compactness, it does provide in ideas. But I think that's what's put the Academy off, is what I'm saying. Because not many nominations for this.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that. If it had been a little more tightly structured, I could definitely have seen it. Maybe, yeah, pushing more into the kind of upper categories. Of course, Grayson Hall did score a supporting actress nomination. But, if it had had a bit more of a structure and a bit more cohesion. Because I agree, there's a lot of good ideas bouncing around in it, but very few of them kind of get any kind of resolution. And yeah, it's never really clear, I think, whether whether Hannah and her grandfather are, you know, con artists or not. He comes up with a pretty decent poem at the end. So he's a poetic con artist, if anything. And I think it would have been a pretty cool reveal if it had turned out that they were just con artists and that Maxine was right. Because of course Maxine calls them out on it immediately, but then she basically says to Hannah, look, you're fine, you know, you do what you gotta do, just don't leech off me all the time, but you know, I get it, She's kind of telling him, I can get it. You can hustle here if you want. Just, you know, pay your bills. So, yeah. I think it's a very fun film, but I agree. It maybe missed out on some higher nominations by not quite being as tethered as as the Academy wanted.
I wanted to ask, because Grayson Hall's nomination, I think, is fine. I think she's pretty good. Was it obvious to you that Judith was a lesbian? I thought that was slightly presumptuous of the characters. That part of it, it didn't sit well with me.
It didn't. I mean, it's not really coming across. I think with most of Tennessee Williams' plays had pretty strong homosexual undertones or overtones, and those all had to be kind of, you know, not tamed, but kind of like really buried in all the films. So it didn't really come quite across to me as much in this film. And I think it is definitely a bit more open in the play than in the film.
Yeah, because the way they're describing it, it's almost like medical, like saying, oh, you know, she's a lesbian, but she doesn't know she is. And I'm thinking, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that to me, that was strange, but maybe that's just a symptom of the time and the way that it's approaching at the time. Bits of casual racism as well, definitely in this, which, you know, probably not surprising. Ava Gardner, I want to mention, like, because it's a bit of a sad case, Ava Gardner, in that she's amazing in this film, should have been nominated for this, but, you know, she was often brilliant and gave performances that were full of personality, but she wasn't always celebrated for that. You know, kind of looks were given more treatment than her ability, which is true of a lot of actresses at this time. But she had quite a big lack of self-worth and often didn't believe in herself and believe in her own ability, which is a real shame. But she did get nominated for Mogambo, and she's great in that, really vibrant and energetic. But yeah, she should have got the nomination for this. She got the Globe nomination but missed out on the Oscar nod. But I think she uses every bit of her body and soul to give us as much of Maxine as possible. Because there was a big deal that she didn't wear makeup. It was the first performance she'd done there. She didn't wear makeup, and this kind of warts and all approach to it. You know, although she still looks great, as you'd expect, David Gardner.
Exactly.
But yeah, lots of like slovenly body language. You know, the way she used her body is quite loose and fascinating. And there's a sense like sort of that she's half drunk throughout. You're kind of thinking, you know, she's too candid for somebody that hasn't had at least a bit of a drink. And you kind of, her and Bert Shannon sort of are the big drinkers, and they're quite similar. And that's why they actually end up together at the end in a way. I did kind of wonder, is she supposed to be half sloshed the whole way through?
She kind of comes across that way, yeah. Which I guess fits the character. I mean, she is kind of like not dealing with the recent loss of her husband at this point, which had only happened like a month before the events of the film. Her husband dies.
3 weeks.
Not even that. So yeah, and she's putting on this very, you know, strong front, kind of brassy front at that point. So it would make sense that she would be a teeny bit drunk as well, to kind of give her the strength to kind of keep up the persona. So yeah, it's a good detail.
The costume design, what struck me most is, you know, more often than not, the clothes fit the characters' personalities very well. And that's a great sign that they've thought about it. Really loved the outfit Hannah's wearing when she first comes up to the hotel with the hat, and she got virtually every inch of her body covered, but for the triangle pointing at her bosom, basically, which kind of fit with the personality. Judith, where, you know, has got this array of haughty dresses that are kind of almost Victorian, but You could tell the way they look. They look expensive. I think this one had... The quality seemed to shine through a bit, which is, might make sense. They probably had the most money of all of these films. This and Charlotte, maybe. But
yeah, I agree. The costume design is really on point and really kind of... gets across the... Not only the personality, but kind of the desperation of all the characters. Like, they're all facing down demons in their own way, and I feel like the costumes that and the clothes that they wear kind of reflect that, which is pretty interesting. And of course, Richard Burton just has less and less on as things go on, as he loses more of himself. Just gets sweaty and the clothes just kind of melt off. It's very, very funny.
I love the bit where he's on the bed drinking the bottle of whiskey and they come in and he just gets the dog collar, the reverend collar, just holds it there because it won't stay there. I'm a priest, but I'm drinking.
Yeah. Yeah, when he's holding that and trying to, you know, try it on in the mirror, and then, yeah, I love it when he, like, holds it up like a shield. It's like, oh, I'm just, you know, priest here, nothing to see. Hilarious.
Do you think he would have been nominated for this if it wasn't for Beckett?
I imagine so, yeah. I think he's better in Beckett, and I think that's the one he should have been nominated for. But yeah, if it wasn't for Beckett, I'm sure he would have been. Yeah. So we have some listener questions.
Just a few.
Andrew Carden. Yeah, just a few. Andrew Carden, given its 7 nominations, do you think Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte was close for Best Picture? And would you have nominated Betty and or Olivia? I kind of doubt it was close to Picture, to be honest.
I thought that, but then I looked at what else could have been nominated. Like, that you've got a lot of the same films nominated in all these categories. So I certainly think it was 6 to 10, but it does definitely seem like a situation where these 5 are way above the rest, even the Best Director lineup matches. So,
and then would I have nominated either of them? Probably not.
No, definitely not for me. Thought Davis was bad, and Crawford would have been better than de Havilland.
David asks, and this is, I have to discuss with you exactly what this question means, but rank the women based on how prolific you think their LGBTQ plus audience is. Mary Astor, Ingrid Bergman, Betty Davis, Olivia de Havilland, Ava Gardner, Deborah Kerr, Agnes Moorehead, Shelley Winters, and Polly Bergen, who he totally didn't forget. Now, my question is, his use of the word prolific in this, what does that mean? Like, how wide or like how sizable their LGBT? Okay. Good question. What do you think?
It's difficult. I mean, this is the order I've got. I've got Davis, Bergman, Winters, Moorhead, de Havilland, Gardner, Kerr, Astor, and then Bergen. But when you think about it, a lot of LGBTQ audience, you know, would have known Agnes Moorehead, for instance, through Bewitched. So she's like a TV icon as well. So the TV element, if you've been in a big TV show, that's probably going to make your audience a lot bigger. So maybe Agnes Moorehead would be, but I certainly think Betty Davis is the biggest LGBTQ icon of the list.
Yeah. No, I would definitely agree with that. And of course, Bewitched was still slightly in the future, or I guess it would have premiered right around the time that this film came out, I guess. So would have been definitely a boost to her profile as well. And she's so good in Bewitched. So
yeah, in 1964. So by the time it came to voting, yeah.
David also asks, how uncomfortable were you with the Sue Lyon storyline in Night of the Iguana? Also, Ava and Deborah should have been nominated. I agree with the second part. What do you think of the first question?
Well, it's difficult to know how old she is, which is what's confusing to me. Like, he mentions that statutory rape is when you sleep with somebody under 20, I think it said, he said in this.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how far under 20 she's supposed to be. I assume that's what is meant by uncomfortable with the storyline.
Yeah. Well, I think she's mentioned as being 16, the character.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I think Sue Lyon was about 18 at the time, but yeah, I think her character was 16.
I mean, Houston definitely lingers in that beach bar dance scene quite a lot.
Yes, indeed. We didn't talk about how hilarious that scene was when the other bus driver just comes and starts swinging wildly and just gets the shit beaten out of him while Sue Lyon is just cheering him on like he's beating the hell out of these two cabana boys when it's never lands a single blow because he's just such a putz. He just doesn't do anything right. But yeah. Anyway, back to that. I guess, you know, it is a huge age gap and a bit of an uncomfortable romance as well. And then, of course, you know, the implication that Richard Burton's character can only resist for so long is a bit creepy as well.
I have to say that, like, I was pleased when her character left the film because she just kept getting in the way of the really interesting relationships and the really interesting drama between the three leads. So I could have done with a bit less of that character, to be honest.
Yeah, agreed. David continues. Which would you rather have happen? Betty calling you a vile, sorry little bitch, or Joan calling you a slut? See Autumn Leaves for context. I don't think I've seen Autumn Leaves. Is that a film he's referring to? So I don't know the context for that. Honestly, I'm not sure which of those I would rather have happen.
Joan Crawford is amazing in Autumn Leaves.
Yeah.
I mean, if Joan Crawford had lived to 2013 and said that to me, she'd have been right. So, I mean, I'm not going to admit to being a vile, sorry little bitch, but I might admit to being slut. I don't know.
If I had to decide between the two, I don't know. Vile, sorry little bitch just has such a kind of ring to it, and it's a little bit more specific. So I don't think I deserve either of those, but what the hell. if Joan calls you a slut, then Betty can call me a vile, sorry little bitch. We'll go with that. And finally, Vivian Leigh and Barbara Stanwyck, this is another David question, Vivian Leigh and Barbara Stanwyck both turned down the part of Miriam after Joan Crawford fell ill. How much do you want to see those versions of the movie? To have Vivian act against Betty, Mary, and Agnes, I don't think my heart could take it. I have to admit, not so much sure about Vivian Leigh, but I bet Barbara Stanwyck would have made a good Miriam.
I agree. But then I also started thinking maybe Vivian would have made a good Charlotte. Could you imagine, like, because then that would be the evolution complete from Scarlett O'Hara to Blanche DuBois to the Southern recluse.
Absolutely. That actually would have been a really good one, yeah. David actually added to this question saying, apparently Katharine Hepburn and Loretta Young also turned down the part of Miriam. So, of course, Hepburn, coming off of Long Day's Journey into Night, maybe felt that she'd had enough of this kind of gothic chamber pieces and didn't want to go down that road again, even though it would have been a different part, but still kind of a... I'm not sure I can see Katharine Hepburn as Miriam, although it's interesting to think what she would have done with it, but I think she's a little too genteel, a little too refined, and to do it, although she probably would have done a much better Southern accent than anybody else in the cast.
Yeah, but yeah, the bar wasn't high, so.
True enough. So thank you, everybody who submitted. Well, thank you, both of you who submitted those questions. And David, as usual, giving us some real fun questions to answer. Wider observations. I know this is the third time we've talked about 1964, but has anything come up in the meantime about this year that we want to talk about?
Well, I did just want to sell our Best Actor episode. We did an entire episode on the Best Actor win of Rex Harrison, which we completely disagree on. Anyone you know wants to check out that rare occurrence where we completely disagree, it's worth a revisit. And also, I don't think we can talk enough about Audrey Hepburn's Best Actress snub, because it was a shocker. Like, and we both probably wouldn't have nominated her, but it was a shocker in terms of it's a snub, leaving the best, you know, the lead character, the lead performance from the Best Picture winner out. You don't really see that very often.
No, yeah, that is pretty surprising. Particularly given the, other than Mary Poppins, kind of the relative dearth of female leads from the Best Picture lineup. And since My Fair Lady pretty much cleaned up the rest of the Oscars and got nominated in almost every other category anyway, it is, yeah, pretty mad to see that, to see her get snubbed. Because if it weren't for Julie Andrews and... well, actually, we could still do Best Actress, couldn't we? This year. because you've only got Julie Andrews and Mary Poppins from the Best Picture lineup, and then the rest are a lot of single nominations, and you got Sophia Loren and Marriage Italian Style, which is a great film. So,
when you think about how different the Best Actress lineup could have looked, we could have had Ava Gardner in there, Audrey Hepburn, Deborah Carr. We could have had, I think there's more. So the fact that, you know, Kim Stanley managed to get in there, Sophia Loren, Debbie Reynolds, is, you know, you have to wonder whether that was close, that some of those could potentially be close to losing out. But, yeah.
Any snubs?
Well, Zorba the Greek, you think?
Yeah, I was thinking Zorba the Greek. I was also thinking A Hard Day's Night could have been in the category. There's some really fun costume design in there, kind of the pre-mod, kind of pre-super long hair Beatles that, you know, when they were still relatively clean cut, still like kind of working class, at least in the film. I feel like there's some really good costume design in A Hard Day's Night, and considering it was got a screenplay and a score nomination, I think it could have easily been in the running for this one.
Yeah, definitely. I think The Pumpkin Eater would have been in with the shot that got a BAFTA nomination in this category.
Yeah.
As did this really cracking little thriller called Psyche 59, which, talking of earlier, you know, it's sort of aging actresses in, you know, genre fare. There's another one this year called Psyche 59, which has got Patricia Neal in it, playing a woman who has gone blind. She's had an accident and she's slowly recovering her sight, but not telling anyone. And her husband's carrying on with her sister. So it's extremely trashy. but that also got a BAFTA nomination for costume design. So maybe in the conversation.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds interesting. I'll have to try. I'll have to find that one. So we come to the immortal question, why did The Night of the Iguana win this Academy Award, and was it a close race? I have to imagine any time Edith Head was in the category, people might have kind of just resigned themselves to a possible loss, so that might have made it close. At the same time, I can't imagine A House Is Not a Home getting a lot of votes, given, you know, just its kind of middling status. Like you said, it is a proper B film, you know. So I don't know if it was close. I have to imagine probably Rene Hubert was probably the closest, just because of what we were talking about earlier about kind of the glamour and the kind of noteworthiness of those few costumes that he did for Ingrid Bergman, that would probably be my guess as the runner-up.
I don't know. I mean, Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte did get 7 nominations, so that's a lot of support across the branches. But, you know, again, we've got the issue of de Havilland, basically de Havilland's wardrobe was her own. I don't know how many people knew that at the time. Maybe the fact that the same costume designer had won 2 years previously for Baby Jane, maybe somebody that, you know, had not been nominated previously to that, maybe they thought that was overkill. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. I think it could have been close. It's a difficult one to call, but if it was close, I would think it would Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte or The Village, or the Visit would be the contenders there rather than the other two.
Like Edith Head, Dorothy Jenkins was a well-nominated, well-loved figure in her field. She was a previous winner with Edith Head for Samson and Delilah. So interesting to see them then going up against one another. But yeah, it seems like she did a really good job. There was lots of noteworthy costume design that she did. And yeah, it just kind of makes sense. I think it makes sense that she won.
Yeah.
But, yep. Ready to rank?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, this was your category, so you kick us off.
Okay, so at 5, it's Kisses for My President. I think, you know, even the costuming didn't stand out as particularly strong, despite the fact that every element of the film pretty much was woeful. So, yeah, I don't know what more there is to say about that. 4, I've got Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, which I would have had at 3 until I found out about this de Havilland situation. And it soured me on that, to be honest, that the costume design for one of the characters is not valid to judge as part of this. So, and I didn't love the costume design in the first place. So, 3, I've got A House Is Not a Home. It was difficult to see some of it, but what we could see was extremely classy. Not all on All About Eve level, but kind of approaching that style of things with the some of the outfits Winters wears later on in the movie. But yeah, it's a shame that we don't have the ability to see more. 2, I've got Night of the Iguana. I thought the clothes fit the characters the most out of any of these movies in terms of the ensemble. It really thought about each character and made a decision as to what felt right on them. And 1, I have The Visit because it has the best outfits, even though it has relatively few outfits. And it's also playing with fashion in a way that the others aren't. It's fun. It's sort of cheeky even. It's outrageous. It's bold. It's European. Yeah, it just ticked a lot of boxes, and I was pretty floored by some of the outfits in The Visit. So yeah, that would be my winner.
Once again, we have a pretty similar lineup here. I also have Kisses for My President at the bottom. Like you said, the clothes fit, and that's about the best I can say about it. A lackluster effort for a lackluster film. And I don't know what it is about this category, that there always seems to be one film that just has no evident costume design. But at least, you know, with ones like The Swarm, it's actually just a fun movie to watch. This one didn't have anything to go for. It was just a chore. I have A House Is Not a Home at 4, simply because, again, it's Edith Head, it's gonna be good, but it was like decent costume design, but in service of, again, not a great movie. And I feel like if the movie had more of a sense of what it wanted to be instead of kind of bouncing around, that might have given it more cohesion and might have helped with the costume design. But what we see is fantastic. Obviously, it's Edith Head. Number three. I have Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte, and just like you, I dropped at a spot when I heard that De Havilland was just wearing her own clothing, which, you know, definitely elevated my respect for her taste in clothes, but definitely also was a point against the costume design when you're like, oh, thank God, thank goodness, one of the lead characters, we don't have to bother designing costumes for them. That's a real load off of Norma Cook's plate, for sure. Number two, I got Night of the Iguana. Fantastic looking outfits. And again, you know, we're getting into the Night of the Iguana is just showing a lot more passion, a lot more heat, but that just is equaled and I mean, exceeded by The Visit. So I've got The Visit at number one because the costumes are amazing to look at and they advance the story and fit the characters so well. You know, obviously I'm thinking in particular about Carla here, but of course I think the rest of the costume design fits the characters and the town really well as well. But obviously Carla's clothes just give her this kind of smoldering, again, almost goddess-like quality, which is befitting the story. As you say, it's a fable, so it makes sense that she would have this larger-than-life powerful look. So the costume design just hits it out of the park. So yeah, it's my number one.
Okay. It's a very similar, but I think this was an easy one to rank pretty much until we had that spanner in the works.
So we have a website. It's categoricallyoscarsgot.com. We're on Twitter at categoricallyo. We're on X at categoricallyo, whatever. Listen to us on Spotify. Drop us a review. Drop us a comment on that website I just mentioned if you have the time. Yeah, keep the questions coming. We are going to take our annual Christmas break, but we will be back in January with some new episodes, some new guests coming on 2024, which we're excited about. And yeah, join us then when the new category will come as a surprise to us all, because I haven't picked it yet.
We'll make it a good one for sure.
For sure, yeah. All right, well, we will see you all in 2024. Have a good holiday.
Hush, hush, sweet Charlotte. Charlotte, don't you cry. Hush, hush, sweet Charlotte. He'll love you till he dies. Oh, darling, please hold him tight and brush the tear from your eyes. You weep because you had a dream last night, you dream that he said goodbye. He held two roses within his hand, two roses he gave to you. The red rose tells you of his passion, the white rose his love so true. Hush, hush, sweet Charlotte, Charlotte, don't you cry. Hush, hush, sweet Charlotte, he'll love you.